and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the much-anticipated speech by Trump at CPAC, where he made it clear he is the Republican Party and its kingmaker, and that while he won't form a third party, he also won't rule out running for the presidency in 2024. Joining us is a politics reporter based in Washington who has covered many CPAC events, Ben Jacobs, who currently writes for New York Magazine and formerly for The Guardian and The Daily Beast. He joins us to discuss his articles at New York Magazine, Trump's CPAC blast in the past, and the new CPAC makes the old CPAC look like the resistance. We will discuss the biggest applause lines Trump got, which were when he claimed he actually won the last election, to which the crowd chanted in response, "You won," and his denigration of the 17 Republican lawmakers who voted to oust him from office, like who we called Little Ben Sass, who Trump proclaimed needed to be purged, vindictively shouting to wild applause, "Get rid of them all." Then we will speak with David Weigel, a national politics correspondent with The Washington Post, who was at CPAC before and during the whole event, about his latest article, "Trump Rules Out Third Party as He Moves to Firm Up Control of GOP." We will discuss the voter suppression measures Trump outlined based on the big lie he won an election the Democrats stole, and how 97% of the attendees approved of his performance in office. Then finally, we'll speak with Rob Wallace, an evolutionary epidemiologist with the Agroecology and Rural Economics Research Corps, about his new book, Dead Epidemiologists, on the Origins of COVID-19. He joins us to discuss the role of climate change and deforestation by agribusiness, which is leading to emergent diseases and the spread of pathogens into local livestock and human communities. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Ben Jacobs, a politics writer based in Washington, currently writing for New York Magazine and formerly for The Guardian and The Daily Beast. His latest articles at The New York Magazine include Trump's CPAC blast in the past and the new CPAC makes the old CPAC look like the resistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Jacobs.
Thanks, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you've been covering CPAC for quite a while. Obviously, there was a lot of anticipation about Trump's speech, and he certainly captured a lot of attention. But some of the reviews, if you will, indicate it was a little low energy. How did it strike you?
It struck me as it was relatively low energy for much of the speech, though it picked up when he got into sharing his grievances about the election and those who'd wronged him. You know, in a speech that lasts 100 minutes can never quite be high energy the entire time, and that it was a typical Trump speech in that there are times in which it dragged and he seemed bored by his own speech. Then he got to share his own personal gripes with the world and became much more energized because that's what motivates him.
Well, I think in a reasonable world, he should be in a world of trouble, shouldn't he? I mean, instigating an insurrection against the United States government itself. I know he got impeached for it, and it was the second time he's impeached. But this is a man who just is like a political Houdini. So was there any hint of what happened on January the 6th?
None whatsoever. That the speech seemed to take place in this alternate universe, you know, where in which January 6th never happened. That You know, he listed by name all 17 Republicans who voted to first impeach and then convict him, but never said why, never mentioned, you know, what actions he might have taken, that it was sort of very much in this idealized world in which all his election gripes had been were still being aired without any consequences, you know, that not even the consequences of losing Senate seats in Georgia, let alone, you know, a people dying in an armed attack on the United States Capitol, that all this stuff seemed to be, you know, wished away in the room.
So when he said named names, the 17 Republicans that you mentioned, referring, of course, to Ben Sasse, a little Ben Sasse, culminating with "get rid of them all," that was the applause line?
Yes, that was an applause line for a crowd that is very, very loyal to Donald Trump at this point. That was the idea of purging the party of those who'd resisted him was very, very popular. That they took a poll at CPAC, and 97% of attendees approved of the job that Trump had done as president, which was a high for that event. That it's gone from the high 80s into the low 90s into the high 90s, and that he's still, you know, and some of which is obviously self-selecting, but it sort of speaks to how loyal the crowd is at an event where, you know, MAGA hats are now the must-have fashion accessory.
But it also, again, speaks to an alternative universe because, I mean, 500,000 Americans have died. The economy's in free fall. It's a catastrophe by any measure. And, of course, it culminated, his ruinous regime culminated with an attack by the executive branch on the legislative branch, unprecedented. And, in fact, you know, it simply put, it was an attack on American democracy itself.
Yes, but those were issues that didn't take center stage at CPAC at all. That, you know, that the issues, it was all about the culture war and cancel culture and Mr. Potato Head. And that was the crux of the remarks, that this was very much an alternate universe. And what was particularly striking in Trump's remarks is that, you know, during the conference, the House passed what will be the largest spending bill in American history. It's likely to pass the Senate of nearly $2 trillion. And a conservative conference had no concern about the spending, that, you know, this spending $2 trillion got about as much attention as Mr. Potato Head engaging in a new gender neutral marketing brand. That it's a brand, it's a very different party with a very different set of political priorities.
Well, as you mentioned in your article, Ben, Trump, in terms of culture wars, criticized trans women participating in women's sports. That just what came out of nowhere?
That's been something that folks on the right have pushed for a while as sort of a wedge issue because of the fact that there's sort of in the shift on social issues in the United States, there's a majority of Americans are in support of same-sex marriage or in support of anti-discrimination laws. That's one of the few sort of wedge issues where social conservatives see political advantage, but it's always sort of been very, very ginger because, A, it's not the biggest, most important issue. That if you look back over the 2020 election, you had, you know, economic crisis, you had a pandemic, you had, you know, this entire reckoning with dealing with issues of racial justice, that, you know, who's competing in high school sports didn't strike anyone as the most important issue, but it's something there's a panel on at CPAC and something that's sort of wedged up and become a little bit more aware that it's something that's sort of been percolating on the right as a potential issue for a while that folks see as a wedge issue. And it finally made it into Trump's repertoire, that there's sort of some executive actions on this, that obviously Betsy DeVos was issuing orders, but it had never made it out of Trump's own mouth until now.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Jacobs, a politics reporter based in Washington, currently writing for New York Magazine and formerly for The Guardian and The Daily Beast. His latest articles at New York Magazine include Trump's CPAC blast in the past and the new CPAC makes the old CPAC look like the resistance. So Jim Jordan, of course, preceded Trump. And there were rumors that, or reports that Trump was mad at Kevin McCarthy, even though he prostrated himself and came down to kiss the ring in Mar-a-Lago. And apparently Trump was mad at him because he was watching television when McCarthy gave his support for Trump, his undying and unequivocating support, and then standing in the background, Liz Cheney contradicted him and said essentially that Trump's a menace and she wishes he would go away in terms of the party, and that apparently infuriated Trump. So did you get the impression that this party is not just Trump's party, but it could end up being Jim Jordan's house as well? And Mitch McConnell, by the way, who also obviously is on the outs with Trump.
McConnell has a much solid grip on the Senate caucus, but McCarthy famously, didn't become Speaker 6 years ago because of doubts from conservatives and sort of built his way back up now by tying himself to Trump. A lot of that analysis depends on Trump's continued role in the party and what the political landscape looks like in 2022. That every time a Republican retires, they're being replaced by someone who's Trumpier than them. That this is not quite from a left to right thing, but if you talk to Republican operatives, they tell potential candidates, if you have concerns about Donald Trump, if you're not wholeheartedly behind Donald Trump, don't run. It's not, because it's just not going to be worth it for you, because you'll either have to upset voters and cause issues in the primary, or you'll have to say things you don't believe, and which ends up being painful as well, so that folks are really now waiting and that we're seeing the crop of candidates come up. And you can see that in the House where, for example, it's not like the folks in the districts Marjorie Taylor Greene or Lauren Boebert represented in the past were sufficiently Trumpy, but they're getting replaced by someone who's far more that. And that's going to be the test as the party change and as Trump continues to have an influence on the shape of the Republican Party.
Well, that you point out, the 2014 conference, CPAC conference you covered, the uninvited then and now, the invited now, right?
Yes.
It's completely switched around. Carly Fiorina, Pat Toomey, and John Bolton were all keynote speakers, and now they're essentially, kryptonite as far as Trump's GOP is concerned.
Toomey denounced on stage, and those are figures no one would accuse, John Bolton of being moderate. Pat Toomey is the former head of the, very conservative Club for Growth. But the shape of the party has changed, and the shape of what's going on in the Republican Party, which influences CPAC, because CPAC is at the end sort of a gathering of activists, and it reflects where the party's going and where it's moving. That it's the people putting on the conference can't sort of dictate what the people who show up want, and that you can see that even the former head of the group that puts it on, has been allowed, Trump skeptic and has been totally sidelined, Al Cardenas, that the world has changed and that CPAC is a reflection of where the Republican Party is.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Ben Jacobs, is there any sense, though, that this agony, this nightmare, the fact that you and I are still talking about this man, I feel we're sort of being complicitous in a way. I felt that throughout the entire tenure of Trump. And of course, arguably, Trump got something like $5 billion worth of free advertising from the mainstream press to get elected in the first place. So will there be a point, do you think, where we don't have to talk about him?
Probably not. I hate to disappoint you like that, but Donald Trump is still the most popular figure in the Republican Party. He's still a kingmaker. That he's not the level of saturation coverage which some outlets gave his every utterance or every tweet, is obviously sort of one extreme, but that he's not president anymore, that his actions are inherently less newsworthy because he can't lob nuclear weapons at the push of a button, but he is a key figure on the American right, and the debates and what's happening in the Republican Party are going to be a response to him, and the shape of the conservative movement in America and to some extent across the world too is going to be guided by what his actions are. So that you can't, he's still important. He's not president. He matters less now than he did while he was still in the White House, but he's still one of the more influential figures in American politics.
And he gave the attendees at CPAC the marching orders to suppress the votes in the next election. So that agenda would indicate that the Trump Party is not going away. It could come back.
No, the Trump Party is not going away. And, you know, the priority set up by Donald Trump are what permeated CPAC and what permeated the event, that this is a party that's now reflecting all of Trump's sort of pet obsessions in a way that represents a really profound ideological shift. And even though he's out of office, his hold on base Republican voters has not relented.
So windmill farms are still in jeopardy.
Well, they kill all the birds, so obviously you have to be concerned, as Trump falsely claims on stage. And windmill farms are the best example of this, because Trump's antagonism towards wind power stems from a zoning dispute he had at a Scottish golf course. That, you know, the biggest proponent of wind power in recent American history was Rick Perry putting up wind turbines in Texas. But this is a particular Trump personalized grievance, which has now become universalized in the Republican Party.
And when you speak about the universe, Trump said, the world is actually a small piece of the universe. So good to know, right?
I don't think any fact checkers are going to dispute that one.
I thank you for joining us, Ben Jacobs.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ben Jacobs, a politics reporter based in Washington, currently writing for New York Magazine and formerly for The Guardian and The Daily Beast. His latest articles at New York Magazine include Trump's CPAC blast in the past and the new CPAC makes the old CPAC look like the resistance. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the national political reporter for The Washington Post, who was at CPAC before and during the whole event.
A place I long to be. Well, deep down in Florida, well, that's a place I long to be.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Weigel, the national political correspondent for The Washington Post, who covered the 2020 Democratic Race Congress and grassroots political movements for The Washington Post, where he writes for the Trailer newsletter, the author of The Show That Never Ends, A History of Progressive Rock Music. His latest article in The Washington Post is Trump Rules Out Third Party as He Moves to Firm Up Control of GOP. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Weigel.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you were down in Florida at CPAC for the entire conference, and a lot of focus, of course, was on the gold statue of Donald Trump that was apparently manufactured south of us here in Los Angeles, down on Rosarito Beach. And, of course, jokes were made about the Old Testament reference to the golden calf. But what struck you as being the biggest takeaway? Obviously, not the golden calf necessarily.
Well, I was surprised at how much was not surprising from the conference, because if you went unaware that Donald Trump was redefining the Republican Party and what it stood for, I don't know where he's been for the last 4 years. Even in the aftermath of the riots on January 6th, you saw a small group of Republicans say that this guy has no role in our party, and you saw the rest get behind him. And before that, which might be more telling, the Trump departures from the old conservative orthodoxy, just to boil that down to two of them, you know, concern about the debt and shrinking entitlements, and then also kind of openness on some forms of legal immigration. He'd gotten rid of that stuff, and that has not been picked up by anyone in the party. So those weren't surprising. I think what was interesting is that you saw a bit more emphasis from Republicans on kind of anti-transgender rights issues, and you saw Trump himself make that. But if I'm struggling to think of what was new, if you're not already paying attention to the Republican Party post, and then in the midst of Trump's control.
Well, was he low energy, as some have suggested, compared to his rallies before his defeat and before the insurrection?
Compared to, well, they're hot and cold. So they're are versions of Trump speeches where he says what he wants to say, and there are versions where he has a teleprompter, and he goes off the teleprompter. He's not, for somebody his age who's been in the media for about, 40, 50 years, he says he's a tell, which is when he's reading something from a teleprompter and not himself, he'll often say, so important, or good point, or just refer to an item that he read off the screen. So that's never as interesting. You could tell the crowd really perked up. It wasn't getting bored. It was pretty rapt, but it perked up during the mention at the very top about how he was not rolling out a 2024 run. He went back to that a few times. And then when he named specifically the Republicans who voted for his impeachment, those were by far the most galvanizing, exciting for the people in the room. But the rest of it, yeah, I mean, this was kind of C-plus maybe Trump compared to what people have seen some of his. But keep in mind that he likes to feed off energy and sometimes go for incredible lengths of time because he thinks the crowd is enjoying a riff that he's on. The riff could be totally perplexing to people outside the room, but if he thinks it's getting people going, he keeps talking. He prefers to be in a sort of arena with as many people as possible, an airplane hangar. This is a room with maybe 2,500 people in it, which is about a quarter of what CPEC, the conference, usually holds, and that's for pandemic reasons. And yeah, he generally is a little bit less energized, but his persona and his politics are indeed based a lot more on performance and speaking than Joe Biden's are. I mean, Joe Biden, like most previous presidents, makes a statement a day, answers some questions, that's about it, and rallies have not been super important to him.
And again, I'm speaking with David Weigel, who's the national political correspondent who covered the 2020 Democratic race, Congress, and grassroots political movements for The Washington Post, where he writes the Trailer newsletter, the author of The Show That Never Ends, A History of Progressive Rock Music. His latest article at The Washington Post is Trump Rules Out Third Party as He Moves to Firm Up Control of GOP. So in terms of firming up control of the GOP, of course, the straw poll that was done, I think, 55% of attendees support Trump's run for a third term, or a second term, I should say, in 2024, and 97% approve of his performance in office. So have they missed something? Did they miss the pandemic and the insurrection?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the other poll results, because I think there was some speculation online on cable about the top number, the number of people who said immediately they want him to be the nominee. And I saw some analysis that was 55% low. It's not, given the information that you just pointed to, which is that you have a room of people who said almost universally they want the party to be based on Donald Trump's policies, his obsessions, his grievances, and yeah, that carried through the conference. So it is striking, though, that last year they asked that poll question about what you think of his job performance, and it was 95%. This year they asked, it was you know, retrospective, but it was 97%. Yeah, I don't think many people outside the conference would look at what happened in 2020 and say that was not just a good performance, but better than the past 4 years. Because one theme of the conference, let's get out of the meta of just talking about Trump for Trump's sake, was that there needs to be a reshaping of history. Maybe rewriting is too big a word for it. Convincing the country in 2022 and 2024, et cetera, that Donald Trump was an incredibly successful president, that everything was going well, and Joe Biden wrecked it. And that's been difficult because, for example, you had Trump and a couple other speakers did the same thing, say that before Biden took office, we were already just, you know, distributing 1.3 million vaccines a day. Larry Kudlow, Trump's former economic advisor, said that. Trump kind of rambled about it for a bit. The point of that being, when he left office, things were already fixed and we were underway. I mean, Trump at one point separately said if they just waited a week, he'd gotten their term in 1 week, he would have gotten an Iran deal, things like that. The subtext of that is that Joe Biden has been fairly popular, approval rating, you know, closer to 60%, 50%, 70% rating on handling the pandemic. And there is a Republican problem if in 6 months, if the vaccination schedule continues, if life is mostly back to normal, if the economy is good, the argument that things were great and Biden made them worse is going to be very hard to sell outside of the people who think that things are worse. And to be fair, this always happens. And there are a lot of Democrats whose personal standing, economic standing, was better, let's say, in 2019 than it was in 2016. Maybe they weren't doing terribly, but they were doing better. But they didn't say, I love Donald Trump's handling of the economy. There's some partisan role here. The problem for Trump that I'm identifying is for independents, for Democrats, for people who are not in that hardcore golden statue core, it's a little bit harder to convince them Joe Biden presiding over a recovery from, I guess, everything that happened in 2020, that he inherited something bad.
Well, the one thing, though, that he did...
good and ruined it, I should say, the opposite.
Right. Well, but the one thing that Trump did venture into, it seems at length, is when he started to talk about we must pass comprehensive election reforms and must do it now.
Right.
And, you know, there are 253 bills in state houses, and essentially they're based upon what many call the big lie or stop the steal. So they're actually basing a whole kind of idea of electoral reform, and I believe the Republicans are creating a commission of some kind to reform the elections based upon the fact that they were stolen by the Democrats. And as a result, the fear is that just about everything they're proposing and just about everything that Trump proposed at CPAC amount to voter suppression.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. It also consists of things that, well, let's start with the premise. They're after 60-plus lawsuits and a Justice Department that said it was going to hear any cases of fraud that came to it. After all that, there wasn't any in the... And there are all these weasel words. So let's say what we're talking about. There have been a couple of cases of people getting arrested for voter fraud, some in Pennsylvania, some in Texas. Most, if not all, Republican voters. But we're talking about less than a dozen people in that election. And the tragedy here is that this election, handled during a pandemic with the highest turnout in decades, in objective times, people would look at that and say, well done. We did. Everyone involved in this did a very good job. So there isn't a problem to solve. The problem is that Donald Trump would like to be president, and he isn't. And a lot of his supporters feel the same way. So they're going and retroactively changing state laws in order to make the sort of voting that Democrats used more difficult. Some of those, I think, were situational. I don't think, for example, outside of some states that use tons of mail voting, I don't think everyone who voted by mail in Georgia wants to vote by mail in the next election. Actually, they had Georgia runoffs 2 months after the presidential election. Different scale of absentee voting was a little down. More people voted in early because things were a little bit better. But then the things that Republicans are adding and the things that Trump called for were limiting the number of early voting days. Trump suggested only one day, which is a little bit ridiculous given that he voted early for himself in 2020. Things like fewer drop boxes for ballot. Again, none of these investigations found anything to suggest the existence of voter drop boxes where people dropped in their ballots, that was a problem, that any fraudulent voting came from that. And so what you're seeing in the state debate is a lot of misinformation, where people are repeating the worries they've heard from voters. It's kind of this endless loop where people will say that they think the election wasn't fair, and then they'll tell their members because they heard Trump say it or they saw it on Newsmax or what have you, then their state legislator will say, well, my constituents say that they have worries about the election, and to convince them that we need to pass this and this because that's what they say they're worried about. It's very deductive. It's very much based on we want the rules to change because we're unhappy that Trump won. And I'm, in many political debates, I say, well, let's lay out the evidence and see what's happening here. This is entirely just recriminations after the election attempts to make sure that Democrats have a harder time voting in 2022.
And speaking of recriminations, Trump really went after those few Republicans who voted to certify Biden's election and the few Republicans in the Senate who voted to impeach him. He named names.
He did do that. Again, I'd find that under not very surprising. that was speculated about. People close to the former president said that he would probably want to do that on stage, and he did so. And again, that was probably the highest applause, ovation meter stuff of the speech when he named the Republicans that he wanted to get revenge on. He didn't get specific and say he's going to do this or that to campaign against them. He did suggest people donate to his PAC, and if you want to draw the thread logically between him saying I have a new PAC and him saying we need to defeat these people, all right, that's not very complicated. So that excited people, and this is where it gets away from some of the issues. So this conference is mostly about the conservative agenda. It's a little and it's been replaced in many ways by these Trump grievances. That's a great example. Liz Cheney wants, let's say fairly because she's in the House, let's say she wants to be Speaker of the House. Would she have a different agenda than in any other Republican in the House leadership? Not at all. She votes the same way they do. She's been very effective attacker of Democrats in the past, especially on climate stuff. The grievance with her is that she thought that Donald Trump shouldn't have lied about the election and convinced people to attack the Capitol and kill people. For that reason, she's being exercised in the party. So you can't really write about or analyze what's going on there without the premise that it is about grievance. It's not actually about any disagreement apart from Donald Trump's ego.
Right, but could you extrapolate that if they went after her because she was opposed to the idea of lying about the election, claiming a victory when you had a loss, and encouraging people to storm the Capitol and kill people in an attack on American democracy itself, is that to say that the majority of the people at the CPAC conference didn't think that was a problem?
Oh, that's very safe to say. So I didn't interview everybody at the conference. I mean, actually, I was focused, I think, on some of the content from the stages more than the Vox Pop. But I did more of that on the first day and on the last day. And it was incredibly hard to find somebody who said, I'd say it was hard to find somebody who didn't think that the official story of January 6th was a lie, that they might start speculating about how Trump couldn't have been involved with it. It was impossible to find somebody who believed Joe Biden legitimately won the election and people should react in that fashion on those terms. So yes, the polling that you've seen, which I think finds 60 to 75% of Republicans don't think the election was fair. CPAC was probably more like 99%.
Well, just in closing, David Weigel, did you ever run into Enrique Tarrio, the leader of the Proud Boys? Because he was there mingling with the crowd.
Yeah, I didn't interact much with him. I just took a photo and said his name, and he walked away from me. But he was there, and he was, of course, in prison, or not prison, but in jail during the Capitol riots. I did see people. I was covering the riots, not inside the Capitol, but outside. People were trying to break in, and I saw people with, you know, Free Enrique shirts as part of these Proud Boy stacks trying to go in and start fights and invade the Capitol. He wasn't part of that. His role in this is kind of weird. But yes, the violent extremism was outside. I should add here, CPAC controls who enters. It has a fairly, I guess, pretty good bang for the buck ticket, but you have to pay for a ticket to get in, submit a photo of yourself, get a QED code that gets scanned, take a quick medical exam, get your temperature checked, etc. And they were keeping out violent extremists. Whatever people say about the conference, they very clearly were keeping out racists. Now, are there people? If you go to what Donald Trump said and some of the implications of it, you can have that discussion. But the more outwardly violent people and the outwardly racist people were exiled out of there, and they have been for years. But they just, those people are more influential than maybe conservatives thought a year ago.
Well, just in closing, didn't they boo the young woman who urged people to wear masks?
Yes. The Hyatt Hotel had a bunch of rules in order for people to attend for the conference to be held at all. So those were read from the stage at one point. I didn't hear them get read again. I might have missed it. I would say there were signs everywhere, and there were staffers, hotel employees everywhere, encouraging people to put their mask back on. Signs saying you'd be ejected if you were multiple offenders, not leaving it on. And to be clear, you know, leaving it on if you're just sitting in a room not doing anything, taking it off if you're reading something, taking it off briefly if you're taking a photo with somebody or doing an interview. So that part of it was, I didn't focus too much on that because I think that took care of itself. And I don't know, the attitude people have toward the pandemic, I think, is shifting a little as with the vaccine, people see the end of it. So maybe the same conference 9 months ago, that might have been a bit more of a fighting issue. It wasn't really this time. It was just something that people groaned about.
Well, I thank you so much, David Weigel, for giving us a firsthand accounting of what went on down there in what, as your headline suggests in your article at the Washington Post, that Trump ruled out a third party, but he's moving to firm up his control of the GOP. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely. I think that's a fair read of the whole thing.
Again, I've been speaking with David Weigel, the national political correspondent at the Washington Post, who covered the 2020 Democratic race, Congress, and grassroots political movements for the Washington Post, where he writes the Trailer newsletter, the author of The Show That Never Ends, A History of Progressive Rock Music. His latest article at the Washington Post is Trump Rules Out Third Party as He Moves to Firm Up Control of the GOP. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the evolutionary epidemiologist Rob Wallace about his new book, Dead Epidemiologists, on the Origins of COVID-19. Which results in the form of global apartheid. Ghettos are trash dumps with gas pumps exploded and burnt out since before the Great Union. The last punks walk around like mass monks, ready to manipulate the database or break through them. Human rights come in 100th place. Mass production has always been number one. New Earth has become a repugnant place, so it's time to spread the fear that's fun to some.
Too long have we tried to extend our glorious empire out to the stars, only to be driven back.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Rob Wallace, an evolutionary epidemiologist with the Agroecology and Rural Economic Research Corps. He is the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu and co-author of Clear-Cutting Disease Control, Capital-Led Deforestation, Public Health Austerity, and Vector-Borne Infection. And he's consulted with the Food and Agriculture Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And his latest book, just out, is Dead Epidemiologists on the Origins of COVID-19. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rob Wallace.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do you mean by dead epidemiologists? We have over 500,000 dead Americans, but I wanted to get a sense of what you were suggesting there in the title.
Right. Well, in the course of writing this book, our attention was on the specifics of the origin of the virus and how it's spread across the world, the kind of its sociological context, but kept coming up against what I view as to be terrible takes on out of the establishment epidemiology sector. And it's not that people aren't brave and brilliant in terms of the work that they do, but much of their work is unfortunately premised on the assumptions of the greater civilization society that backs up and accepts the interests that have helped bring about the pathogen in the first place. And so one can have the top-of-the-line epidemiological instruments in terms of identifying pathogens, in terms of modeling their spread, and still, by virtue of accepting the premises of the larger system, be unable to see the causes that led to the emergence of the pathogen in the first place.
So, interesting enough, there was a World Health Organization delegation that went to Wuhan recently. And my understanding is that China's top virologist had made the suggestion that COVID-19 didn't actually arise or begin in China. Do you know what he was talking about?
Well, I think there's a lot of things in play here. There is the epidemiological evidence to consider, that is, in terms of the disease's origins, seems to be contradictory. There's a certain kind of fog to it, is a fog of pandemic in terms of understanding how this came about. There is, at the same time, the kind of Cold War play between the U.S. and China over blaming each other for the emergence of the pathogen, an attempt to wash hands of poor decision-making, not just in China, but around the world, including in the U.S. So it's a lot in play in terms of trying to get a handle on the virus's origins, but also in terms of placing it in its political context. And, you know, we spoke about the title of the book, Dead Epidemiologists, and I think here's another example of that in which you have some world-class epidemiologists invited by the World Health Organization to investigate this, but, you know, to the extent to which our hands are bound by both the interests of those who invited them there, both the World Health Organization and China, but also their own interests. For instance, you have, well, let me back up for a second. You've got two primary sets of hypotheses. One, of course, we've all heard the possibility of a lab leak out of one of the Wuhan labs. I don't agree with that, but I do think there is grounds for investigating this. Princeton University put out a paper in 2013 that described the spread of the BSL biosafety labs 3 and 4, those are the labs that handle the most dangerous pathogens. And since 9/11, since the emergence of bird flu H5N1 at the turn of the century, we've had thousands of these labs built around the world in such a way that even a rare event like a lab leak where a virus might exit the back door and into the local population bends toward an inevitability as its opportunities increase to the point that it has so many chances to do that. So there is a real possibility that a lab leaks can happen. Whether that happened in this case, of course, is something to discuss. But the problem here is that one of the members of the World Health Organization team is Peter Daszak, who is the president of the Echo Health Alliance, which is an NGO operating out of New York. And it has gotten money from both NIH and DOD to basically run what are called gain-of-function studies. These are studies in which the viruses are, in essence, selected for increasing deadliness. Now, the question is what is an organization like that doing? It's an ecology organization. What's it doing involved in helping fund and take part in experiments that are selecting for deadliness and pathogens in a lab context? And that's not only in the U.S., but early on working with, you know, Chinese scientists from China and doing that in China as well, including at the Wuhan lab. And so it's really difficult, even as I disagree with the hypothesis that emerged in the lab, it's hard to take the WHO's journey, its visit there, any seriously if you're allowing a member who was involved in the possibility of the emergence of a lab strain on the WHO team to declare that the lab leak hypothesis was dead in the water from the start. So that's a problem, because the context by which we are making decisions about one hypothesis or another aren't necessarily on the basis of evidence as so much as who's protecting what pot of money. So that's the lab leak hypothesis. I'm a proponent of what's called the field hypothesis, that the virus emerged out in the field. And it didn't necessarily emerge first in Wuhan. It, in all likelihood, given the kind of genetic evidence that's been collected and analyzed, that the strain was circulating within humans for a number of years, and that the spillover event from bats into humans, perhaps with a recombinant event with pangolin or other food animal species along the way, occurred several decades ago, and that it took some time to make its way through the population and emerge by kind of immune selection in humans to the point that it could go much more quickly through humans. And so Wuhan is the last station, as it were, for a long train ride between bats, humans, and then a pandemic.
And again, I'm speaking with Rob Wallace, who's an evolutionary epidemiologist with the Agroecology and Rural Economics Research Corps. He's the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu and co-author of Clear Cutting Disease Control, capital-led deforestation, public health austerity, and vector-borne infection. And he has consulted with the Food and Agriculture Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And his latest book is Dead Epidemiologists on the Origins of COVID-19. So if Wuhan was the last stop on the long train of the genesis of this latest disease, you make it clear that these are the result of the global capital drive, the deforestation and development that has exposed these pathogens, and that we are in the age of climate change and agribusiness, and together they exacerbate this condition as we intrude into the natural world in the most horrific ways. But just to finish up on Wuhan, mm-hmm. How do you explain, though, and a lot of obviously hawks on this side and Trump himself try to scapegoat China to get himself off the hook for his mm-hmm. manifest stupidity and incompetence. But the Chinese only lost about 7,000 people. But while they contained it in China, they seem to have allowed it to get out. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, the criticisms, the Chinese do bear responsibility on a number of fronts. One, they took the BRICS road of capitalist development, and for good reason in some part, in the notion that they did not want merely the global north to determine how they were going to develop their resources and not just allow a kind of extractivism out of their country. So they decided we're going to do capitalism with Chinese characteristics. And by virtue of doing so, they pulled millions out of poverty, even though they also left behind millions in poverty. It's not for me to say whether that was the right call, but in the end, really, in the course of self-exploiting their landscape, it led to the kind of, as you described, the kind of extractivism that led to the increase in the interface between animals that are reservoirs for dangerous diseases and locals who are involved in the kind of deforestation and development that is related to the foreign direct investment into the country and also China's own objectives to pull itself forward as a capitalist power. Now, they, in my view, made a decision that in the course of doing so, there was going to be some damage, and they have tried to clean up messes as they have emerged in a very post hoc way. So you have a multiple strains of avian and swine influenza that have emerged in the last 30 years out of China by virtue of its increasing industrialized livestock and poultry operations, its incursions into its, the last of its forest areas, and so on and so forth. So the thought was this is the cost of doing business, and that they would externalize the costs on not just the people of China, but the rest of the world. China's not alone in that position, of course. The U.S. has done that. Europe has done that. You know, the swine flu H1N1 that emerged in 2009 emerged outside Mexico City. Our team calls that the NAFTA flu, post-NAFTA. The U.S. meat dumped on the Mexican market and basically changed the very nature by which hog are raised in Mexico, but also led to the increase in transport of hog from the U.S. into China, and some of the genetics work shows that H1N1 emerged out of strains that were circulating from both North America and Eurasia. So, in other words, we did it ourselves in 2009, this very thing that the Chinese had been doing, have also been doing for several decades. There's a European example of that, H5NX avian influenza, that's been circulating in its industrial poultry. And of course, Ebola in West Africa, it went from a virus that would take out a village or two to then all of a sudden something that spread across three countries, infecting 35,000 people and killing 11,000 people. Our group's interpretation of that is that it's, we've called it the neoliberal Ebola, in that the virus itself did not evolve that much at all. Same clinical course, same epidemiological parameters. But in the course of imposing structural adjustment on West Africa in the course of allowing multinationals to come in and develop the forestry area, it increased the interface again between bats and humans there, allowing increase in traffic of Ebola spillover. So it's a long way around to answering your question, and that is, yes, the Chinese certainly bear responsibility in terms of its merchants. It does bear responsibility in terms of its decision to carry the epidemiological fallout of that work as a kind of cost of doing business. But also, China is not the only one making this decision. So I would actually call upon people to kind of avoid the trap that we've been laid for us in terms of getting us to point fingers in a way that, as if, you know, it's U.S. versus China, as if we're just pawns on a board of a new Cold War, and to think more in terms of that often these countries very much work together. I mean, we began this conversation talking about Peter Daszak. I have no problem with people, scientific cooperation across countries, but there's an example in which, you know, scientifically, if you are in favor of the lab leak hypothesis, where China and the U.S. work together using NIH money to lead to the kind of gain-of-function studies that may have led down that direction. If you believe the field hypothesis, again, you have these interlocking directorates between the U.S. and China. Post the housing crisis, you had investment firms like Goldman Sachs diversify their holdings by investing in Chinese agriculture, including investing $300 million in poultry farms in a province south of Wuhan. So they were already involved, U.S. companies, U.S. Capital involved in changing Chinese agriculture that led to the emergence of new pathogens. So I would ask us to think, to kind of drop out of the kind of geopolitical stuff, although, of course, that's still important, but to think in terms of how Earth is being foundationally changed in its epidemiology and its environmental course by virtue of these kind of interwoven circuits of capital that connect one side of the Earth to the other across borders, and in such a way that our group views cities like New York, London, and Hong Kong to be the worst disease hotspots by virtue of supplying the capital that drives the deforestation and development that leads to the spillover of these new deadly pathogens.
And just to finish up on it, of course, the capital investment flows both ways because Chinese own Smithfield, right, the biggest pork producer in the world, and they've had obviously have poor working conditions where the absolutely. Workers have been getting COVID, you know.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. I mean, this is why, you know, to drop out of the kind of conflict that in essence allows both countries to wash their hands by blaming the other, when in fact the political class and the capital they serve were foundationally involved working together to, in essence, though that wasn't their objective, but by virtue of collaborating on the kind of development that leads to the spillover, in essence, work together to select for pathogens that are emerging this way.
So, Rob, let's turn to the broader issues which you've been working on for decades and written about, and of course, also have written about in your new book, Dead Epidemiologists, on the origins of COVID-19, and that is the extent to which human intrusion into the natural world at the behest of agribusiness and factory farms, which are, I guess, also connected to that intrusion. That is where we already have a series of eruptions of viruses, H1N1, H7N9, SARS, MERS, Ebola, and Zika, and now COVID-19. So that is at the heart of it, isn't it? I mean, apparently, I've seen pictures, but on Borneo, for example, in Indonesia, you go through the rainforest and then you suddenly look out at, as far as the eye can see, palm oil plantations that they've just absolutely decimated, these tropical rainforests. And not only, of course, are the orangutans now endangered, but the idea that this is all being done, this hideous and irretrievable destruction of the natural world is all being done to make a product that's incredibly unhealthy in the first place. So can we do something, get an international ban on palm oil? Is there any way to stop this hideous destruction?
Yeah, I mean, you are basically asking us what I view as the kind of existential moment that our species is having. I mean, we are confronted by either continuing along a pathway that leads to the the very destruction of humanity and the collapse of civilization. And, you know, it's a very grandiose declaration, but one sees what is happening in Borneo and elsewhere, and one can't help feel that we've been brought to a moment with we view, you know, quarterly returns as being realer than the ecology upon which we all depend. And, I mean, my view is that we're presently being led by a class of sociopaths, and, you know, not in the medical term, but in the sense of, you know, our best and brightest are organized around the kind of exercise of political power that assures our very destruction. And how do we deal with that? And it leads up, I mean, there are wonderful people everywhere, even doing incredible research, doing the right thing, even in some of the most ominous organizations. I know people object to the World Bank and you object to the IMF, and for good reason. But, you know, there's incredible research being done investigating these very dynamics. But, you know, the mechanism of political power is such that we are at a moment where the system is not in a position to correct itself by virtue of national and international intervention, because those institutions have, in essence, been corrupted by the money that backs it. Now, the way I see things moving forward is that we have to start looking at other means by which political power is exercised, and that involves people around the world beginning to find and look to each other to organize in a way to, in essence, replace the present political system with something else that, in essence, stops alienating or abstracting out human relationships from the ecological and environmental world upon which we depend. And so, in essence, there's a matter of following the indigenous ways. They've been asking us for, telling us 500 years, calling us back to Earth, because we have, in essence, left the planet, and to return humanity and into the fabric of the ecological relationships upon which we depend. And that involves a considerable fight and pushback, and to do so in short order in the face of the facts of the matter that we are coming up against multiple environmental precipices that could very well lead to the collapse of the civilization as we know it. So that is the true struggle. And, you know, I always speak to young folk, and I apologize. I say, this is not your fault. But however, you are being placed in a position of having to, in essence, bring back our species from the brink of destruction. And we are in a place where our very best and brightest are urging us on across these precipices. And the solution then involves looking to people who are often marginalized and often are asked to bear the worst costs of this damage, and to start organizing across international borders. And to, as one farmer put it, it's going to take internationalism to defeat globalization. So it's a generational project. It's not easy. I'm not opposed to, you know, transitional demands. I'm not opposed to trying to get some world ban on expanding palm oil infiltration as the Southeast Asia uses all its land for palm oil. Then we have incursions into sub-Saharan Africa and into South America. And, you know, I go back and I think about when I was in third grade and I was given assignment, I think, to do a report on Ecuador. And I remember even then we all knew that this terrible things were happening. And I remember as a third grader looking up at the global map and thinking about this, and at least saying to myself, well, you know what, at least we have the Amazon and the Congo, you know, the lungs of the earth, as it were, or as I thought as a third grader. And yet here we are. We are cutting into it, cutting it down. And it really speaks to the terrible power that this kind of systemic momenta that we're caught in. And it's not going to be a matter of just talking to people and trying to convince them. Our group put out a paper modeling, in essence, the a fight between agribusiness and public health, and presently public health is losing, and clearly the pandemic is a marker of that, but it goes beyond that. I mean, much of the damage historically has been imposed by a global north on the global south, treating the Global South as both its refrigerator and its toilet. And that led to the deaths of millions of people per year by virtue of the environmental damage and the epidemiological consequences. But now we've gotten ourselves into a place where the Global North is riding us, the entire world, into the damage that we all face now. So things like climate change and pandemics aren't just concentrated along the equator. They're everywhere all at once. And so the thought that we could just leave that behind in the Global South, which is an awful and terrible thing, is now something that can't keep us, those of us in the Global North, clear of the damage. The damage is now coming back to those of us who have pushed it forward. And it's going to require us all to, in essence, reject our lords and masters in favor of a system that returns us back to Earth, as the indigenous groups have invited us, and to repair the disparities between Global North and Global South. It's going to require us to decolonize our systems. It's going to require us to engage in the kind of eco-socialist interventions that basically make sure that people are taken care of, but we also have an earth upon which we depend, and that it's there and available for us to continue to survive. I mean, I do not oppose appropriating things from Earth. We do have a right to survive, but that's a difference from, that's different from expropriating Earth to the point that we leave it in ruins. So I wish it was merely a matter of a global ban on some of these plantation monocultures. But unfortunately, the problem is much more radical in the sense of down to the root of some of the very assumptions under which much of the world is operating.
Well, Rob Wallace, you've really given us a lot of reasons to read your book, and I'm very grateful for your new book, Dead Epidemiologists on the Origins of COVID-19, and I'm grateful for you joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure, Ian. I appreciate that.
And again, I've been speaking with Rob Wallace, the evolutionary epidemiologist with the Agroecology and Rural Economic Research Corps. He's the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu and co-author of Clear-Cutting Disease Control, Capital-Led Deforestation, Public Health Austerity, and Vector-Borne Infection. And he's consulted with the Food and Agricultural Organizations and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And his latest book is Dead Epidemiologists on the Origins of COVID-19. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the